Hello and welcome to Untouched, the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. In this series, we delve into the themes of touch, tangibility and intangibility in engagements with art, whether it's on trips to galleries and museums, in curatorial practice, in creative practice, or just in everyday situations. We'll be asking questions like, what does it mean to physically interact with visual culture? What can we get out of non-visual engagement with art? How has the pandemic changed the way we interact with art? And what happens when we encounter the intangible and the unknown? I'm Gareth Hughes, a doctoral researcher at Royal Holloway, and today I'll be talking to Sarah Douglas, director of the Liminal Space, about translating complex ideas into interactive experiences, and how visual culture can bring social issues to a wider public audience. Hi, Sarah. Welcome and thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Royal Holloway's Centre for Visual Cultures podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, could you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved in the Liminal Space?
Sure. So I'm Sarah Douglas and I'm founding director of the Liminal Space. And we are a purpose-led creative agency that use art and design approaches to change how people think, feel, and act on social issues. My personal background is quite a patchwork quilt of art, innovation, education, and learning. So I studied fine art and did an MA at the Royal College of Art, so where I studied painting. So quite different to the work I'm doing now, but always had a real love for making and the role that making and visual culture plays in helping us to think about society and wider social topics. And from doing that, I always sort of had to find ways of sustaining myself financially. It's not easy for artists. And so I'd always come up with quite entrepreneurial ways of doing that. So I'd run a small business before, which was connecting corporate finance with artists in the East End of London. And then really started the Liminal Space out of an interest in art-based approaches and how they could be used more widely. And that followed working at the Royal College of Art's Innovation Department, which was a unit that connected new startup ventures in art and design with commercial applications. So I think there was always an interest for me in enterprise and entrepreneurship kind of running through my areas of work and interest. And then that all really, I'd also taught. So I taught at university for a long time in fine art and cultural theory. And really for me, Liminal Space was a way to kind of bring all of those strands together. So art and design approaches, entrepreneurship and enterprise and learning and education. So, you know, that's really been, is now still the kind of heartland of the organisation.
Oh, that's fabulous. It's great to know that the Liminal Space sort of developed out of your love for visual culture. So for the benefit of our listeners, could you give a brief summary of what the Liminal Space sets out to do?
Absolutely. So we are a multidisciplinary studio. So that means that as part of the team, we've got researchers, we've got artists, we've got graphic designers and creative practitioners of all kinds. And our mission is to use art and design to engage people on issues of social or strategic importance. So to give you some examples, we work with brands, we work with museums and cultural organizations, we also work with big trusts and charities, so people like the Wellcome Trust, National Lottery, We've worked with brands like Selfridges, and we work with museums like the Natural History Museum, the V&A, and across that spectrum, really, we're working on particularly knotty or complex, important social topics and how we can help different public audiences contribute to and understand them. So that might be, how do we help young people engage with climate change in a way that makes them feel empowered and hopeful rather than laden with climate grief? Or that might be, how do we help people think about gene editing and the impact of gene editing on the future, which is a project we're currently doing with the Francis Crick Institute. So our work is quite broad in terms of the topics that we deal with, but the processes are rooted in human-centered, people-centered design. So that's really thinking through, here is your audience, what is the change that you're trying to create or get them to think about, and then coming up with the creative solution to enable that change. And so because of that starting really with people and purpose, the outputs of our work are really varied. So sometimes the right solution might be a film, sometimes it might be an installation, sometimes it might be a campaign, sometimes it might be a health intervention. One of our programs, which is called Nightclub, works with shift workers and looks at the long-term health implications of shift work. And that is a traveling health intervention that takes place with our business partners at night on site where shift workers are working. So all of our outputs are very different depending on the nature of the challenge.
Gosh, yeah, that sounds so varied. It's such a rich variety of projects you've got on the go. And so I was wondering, like, what sort of brings it all together, and this idea of like the liminal, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about what that means in this context.
Yeah, so I think the word liminal is much more heavily used now than it was when we first set the company up, not claiming to be a trailblazer, but you know, coming from an art school background, the word liminal was used quite a bit in the context of thinking about spaces that were spaces of transition, spaces. I mean, the word originally comes from anthropology and refers to a moment where a culture is in transition from dominant old ways of doing things to emerging new ways of doing things that have not yet been categorized or claimed yet. So that very much is the way we think of a liminal space. And that is really exciting for our practice because we very much believe that it's in this emergent space that exciting things happen, that important questions need to be asked, that you need to draw insight from the margins into the mainstream. And so for us, that perfectly describes the practice that we have and the work that we do.
I love that. I love that idea of transitioning from the old to the new. It's really interesting to hear about how socially engaged your projects are. And when you're thinking about engaging with the public, what are the main considerations you have in mind when you're thinking about presenting an idea to the public?
So across our work, when we think about the public, it could be kind of varied publics. So the first thing that we think about with every project, you know, is who do we need to participate in this conversation? And who is our kind of end audience that we're trying to reach? And they might be quite different. So to give you an example, one of the projects that we've done, which was a collaboration, that's another big part of our practice, is it's highly collaborative. And we tend to work in partnerships with universities, research institutions, businesses and funders and communities. So it's very much kind of melting pot. And the project I'm going to describe is called Unclaimed. And it was a partnership between the Barbican, Wellcome Trust and UCL and 100 community groups across London. And it was thinking about the future of aging. So thinking about aging within aging population, and the key challenge there was, how do we get a younger population to think in advance about the time bomb that is going to be the aging population and a crisis in social care, and particularly the sort of inequality of aging today and the experience of aging today. So in that case, our kind of end target audience was to motivate and engage people, you know, under 35. But the participants that we really needed to involve in those was the people with lived experience, with people who are, you know, 75 plus. So we really start out the project by thinking, you know, who are the voices that we need to have as part of this program, but also very much, but what is the output that we need to create that's going to engage our final target audience? So what we did in that project is we spent 6 months doing research with older people across London, and worked with community groups across the city, but worked with very diverse community groups. And as part of that research, we used creative techniques. So, for example, instead of having doing a research focus group, we had a pop-up nail salon. So we took our pop-up nail salon to these community groups, because we identified from speaking to people that really what older people wanted, particularly older women, was to have an opportunity to be pampered, to feel good about themselves, to have a date night, to do all the things that anyone, you know, would like to do. And so whereas researchers had typically approached that by, you know, having focus groups, instead we brought researchers along with us, had this kind of amazing pop-up nail salons where we had women across the ages and men talking about their experiences and their lives as part of a really fun kind of social interaction. So that we use those approaches to obtaining insight and to obtaining people's lived experience stories and first-hand stories. And then from that we worked out, you know, what would our final kind of exhibition output be. And so then we created an installation in the Barbican Centre that was in a kind of high footfall public area, and that was, you know, creatively bringing these stories to life. So we had a fictional lost property office where you could kind of root through objects, and the objects, you could open books that would tell you stories, so all of the objects in the space told different stories. And we didn't have any images of older people. We didn't have, you know, we knew that some of the kind of visual cues that would really put younger people off are to be able to, you know, to sort of think about the stereotypes of older people. So we avoided all of that, and we just made this actually a really fun environment. And we did quite quirky things, like we took the stories of older people, but we actually had like kids voicing them. So you didn't know what age this person was, because of course, you know, we all experience things in the same way. And so, you know, that's an example of how creatively we really are always thinking about, you know, what is the message that you're trying to get across to which audience group.
Oh, that's really interesting, especially on that last point with it's almost like you were taking away the visual cue of and the auditory cue of what an old person might look or sound like. And it's really interesting how you play with that. And it seems like you're really interested in playing with the sensory in all your projects. That's great. Thank you for that. That was fabulous. Could you give a specific example of how the liminal space has taken a particular research question and has developed it into an experience that people can participate in?
Yes, absolutely. So we were working with UCL's healthcare engineering team and the Museum of the Home, and our specific question was around, how can we imagine more inclusive futures for what the future of home might be like? And we were really thinking about the future of home in very broad terms. So, you know, what might the future of home be like against a backdrop of climate change, against a backdrop of an aging population, future of work, some of the big kind of macro drivers in economic and kind of global terms. And for us, what we're really keen on doing is making sure that it's not just within universities and within policy spheres that people get to think about what the future may or may not be like, but that that is a process that you can provide for us as citizens to also have the agency and to be able to dream up and imagine the kind of futures we might like to see, rather than just be recipients of futures that are sort of handed down to us. And so it is really important for us that we're working with communities in thinking about the kind of futures that they would like to see and be part of. So what we is always a starting point for our projects is to really run a lot of community-based workshops to understand how communities feel about these issues, but also then to use our partnerships with academics, with experts, to think through, okay, how might we bring those topics to the public? So working particularly with UCL's healthcare engineering team, who are developing new medicines, new wearables, new forms of technology that will help people to live longer and more independently in their homes. But what are some of the pros and cons of those technologies? So we'd work with the academics to help think through how we bring that to the public, and then we as designers will create that sort of translation mechanism for the public. So that's where we'll take stimulus into workshops to really garner people's views on how they see the future. And then through that insight, plus our own kind of creative research, we came up with our vision, a collective vision really for the future of the home. And this was an installation that took place at the Museum of the Home, and we had several rooms that you could walk through and experience. And within that, had used very sort of playful ways of bringing some of these themes to life. So one example that we had was a toilet that you could it would sort of track your biological information. But then equally, you can see the massive health benefits in that, being able to identify if you have kind of upcoming health issue or challenge. But then equally, what if your toilet could tell if you were having an affair? How would you feel about that? And how might that change the sort of dynamics in your household? Equally, we were thinking about how you might have a community garden space, which is something that already sort of exists as a we all know that as a kind of urban space, but how might that community garden space might be growing completely different vegetables based, because we're thinking now about climate change, and how might we have Mediterranean fruits in this space, and how might that kind of completely change how we used social spaces as a country, as a community. Then we also envisaged a whole scheme, which was essentially that you might get a kind of rebate on your council tax for housing climate migrants, or for housing people who were affected by loss of earnings due to the sort of advance of technology and automation in the workplace. So we're imagining these sort of civic schemes that might exist in the future. So we do a lot of this kind of future, speculative futures, creative work to come up with some of these ideas. And one of the more fun things we had in the space was a fictional service where you could like have tea with your dead relatives, where AI would sort of bring granny to life, and you could sort of subscribe to a service where you could meet with granny or grandpa or anybody that you want, could even be a dead celebrity, to get their advice on love and life, or to talk through football scores, or to talk through anything you want. You could sort of summon these people into your home to connect with them in new ways.
Wow, that sounds amazing and somewhat unnerving at the same time. But did you get a sense of how people interacted with that and how they felt about that?
Yeah, so it was, I mean, it was a really great project for us, because it was the first build project that we did post COVID. And we'd had to change our practice completely, and having been a sort of very much kind of known for our installation work, we'd had to sort of really pause a lot of that work during COVID. And so this was our first kind of back into an immersive space. So it was, fantastic to be able to do that. But also, we had such brilliant feedback, both from the community, and I think for the museum, it was a really new way of working because obviously museums are really concerned with the past and preserving the past. Whereas the question that we were asking here is, right, communities and individuals tell us, what do you want to see in the future, and how can we think about the future, and how can we use museums as a space to enable citizens to come together to think about their future? And we're very much involved in that work across the cultural sector. We've just launched a program with UKRI. It's called Mindsets for the Future of Museums, and that's really thinking through how museums can and cultural spaces can be much more civic spaces for sites of discussion around future of climate, future of work, thinking through, what the past can teach us about the future and how communities can be better brought into those conversations.
Sure, yeah. And speaking of like the influence of COVID, do you think that the public and the audiences are coming to engage with your projects? Are they doing so differently after the pandemic? Are people I don't know, are people coming as in large numbers, or are they reluctant to touch things and get interactive, or are they preferring a more digital experience? What do you feel?
I actually think we will and are seeing a real desire to do more stuff in person, to be more connected to things. I mean, I think there is a balance. And so, for example, we do, as our part of our practice, run a lot of workshops and learning programs. And we find obviously the number of people that you can reach online is massively expanded, and it's cheaper to do it. And so a lot of our clients are kind of saying, oh, we want to turn it online. But then when you actually ask people how they prefer to engage, it's still very much in person. So I think the hybrid model's definitely made its way into our practice in the sense that we might kind of run a few of our programs, but have some very intense in-person days and then go online for some of the other work. So we're definitely in terms of our practice, bringing that hybrid model more and more into our practice. But I think, we did a project with the Natural History Museum over the last year. It was called Our Broken Planet, and it was about the Anthropocene and engagement with climate change and helping young people to engage with climate change in new ways. And it actually got the highest numbers that the Natural History Museum had ever seen. It had 1.2 million visitors, which is higher than any exhibition of that kind that they've done. And that was during, the end of COVID and finished in August this year. So I think there is appetite, and I think there is, even more appetite actually for human to human contact and experience.
For sure, yeah. And yeah, just I suppose there's not much of a substitute for just being there. But then people interacting with these things on several different levels. I mean, I've heard you speak before about visitors having a kind of selfie moment in exhibitions and spaces like yours. So I was wondering about, especially from like a sort of visual culture angle, is that why is that such an important part of experiencing these things?
So I think because we work across different sectors and we are predominantly engaging, well, we're engaging different demographics, different people, we as a practice just have to make sure we're hyper aware of how it is that people are engaging with things. So it might not be my personal preference as a way to engage, but we always have to look at the audience that we're working with and to. And I think it's just such a massive part of visual culture to record the things that we're doing and how we're doing it and share, recording and sharing. And that there's also kind of micro trends within that. So, one of the micro trends that we've seen is that the way aesthetically that people are recording themselves. There's micro trends even within the ways that people are sharing their own experiences. For example, one of the things we've seen is that a shift from, let's say, more filtered, more glossy, more staged ways of sharing to the prevalence of things like Be Real and a much bigger desire to kind of share sort of warts and all more authentic visions and versions of our daily experiences. So I think it's not only about being aware of the dominant trends of within visual culture, but even the sort of emerging trends within how it is that people are engaging with those platforms. And I'm sure that, you know, we're going to see with AI another massive explosion and changes in the way that we engage. So for us as a creative agency, in order to do trailblazing work, we have to be on top of these things all the time and sort of integrate them into the ways that we are designing our work and designing our programs. And that might not be relevant for all audiences, but certainly if you're, you know, working with audiences that are you know, under the age of 50, then you know, we need to have those sort of shareable moments in there. So I think it's about, again, kind of identifying who your audience is and what's going to be important to them and how they want to engage, and providing different levels of engagement. I think that's really important too, that you enable people a kind of 30-second engagement, a 3-minute engagement, a 30-minute engagement, a 3-hour engagement if you want it, so that there are these sort of different levels of engagement that are possible.
Sure, absolutely. In this podcast, we also like to think about the unseen, the intangible and the inaccessible when we're talking about visual culture. And so I was wondering, in what way does the liminal space help us to engage with unseen knowledges and experiences?
So I guess the kind of big part of our practice is that we spend a lot of time working in those unseen, intangible spaces in terms of large complex concepts like AI and how is automation going to affect our future work lives. Those are sort of massive concepts that it's really hard to get our head around. Or DNA, you know, what does gene editing, what are the technological possibilities of gene editing and how are those going to affect us ethically? So I would say the kind of core bit of our practice is to spend loads of time in that really intangible space and then look at ways of drawing those topics into the tangible, look at ways of using storytelling, using creativity to make those things more tangible so that people can think about them, discuss them, so that they do make sense to them. And so I think that's the kind of core thing that art and design approaches can do, is to kind of help bring complexity into a tangible form. Outside of that, we do describe ourselves as somewhere between a design studio and a think tank. And so a lot of the work that we do that's not as seen in the public domain is research and strategy that we do for different organizations, which is, you know, is spending a lot of time in that more kind of cerebral space of sort of trying to help organizations to create strategies that have people and planet at their heart. And that might not always have a tangible physical output. So our practice is very dual in that way, and I suppose the work that we're maybe most known for is that physical embodied work, because you can see that work in spaces, you can visit it, you can engage with it. But I think it's essentially they both come from the same place, which is being in a domain of inquiry and, you know, having your senses kind of heightened by being in a sort of space of exploration, intellectual inquiry as an organization with our clients, with the communities that we work with. And sometimes that inquiry has a kind of physical manifestation, and other times it is, you know, a collaborative exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think many researchers will sort of relate to that sort of, yeah, the sort of speculative and the cerebral process that goes on. And what I like about the liminal spaces work is how it bridges that gap between the speculative and what isn't seen, and then bringing it into a tangible reality. I suppose I wonder, on behalf of a lot of postgraduates and researchers, like, what kind of advice would you have for them if they would really want to sort of translate their ideas into this kind of tangible experience that generates impact for wider audiences?
So the advice that I would offer in terms of translating your work in a more tangible form is to start out by speaking to somebody not in your field, and ask them how they relate to your work, how they relate to the topic, how they understand it, and to try to explain it to them. So I think one of the things we often find working with researchers is that people are understandably really passionate and engaged in their particular subject area and might not realize how big a gap there is between their knowledge and understanding and your average person in the street. So the first step is to really understand the gap there and to get to grips with that, understand how big that gap is, and just put yourself in the either the viewer, the audience, the participant, the community's shoes. Anyone who's not in your deep research expertise, and to try and understand how they relate to your work and your topic from their perspective. And that's the first step, really, to then being able to understand, okay, well, what have I got to do to bridge that gap? And then thinking about the mechanisms through which you might bridge that gap in a way that is fundamentally engaging, useful, relevant, beneficial, interesting to that viewer or that participant, rather than how best do I communicate my work.
That's really great advice, and I'll definitely be taking that on board and thinking about my own research. Thank you for that. So just as we come to the end of the podcast, there are a few speedy questions that we like to ask every guest that we have on Untouched. And the first one of these I'd like to ask you is, what is your favorite piece of visual culture that you've worked on directly or been involved in?
So this is a really tricky question. There are so many to choose from. I'm going to go for our project called Unclaimed, which was at the Barbican Centre and looked at ageing today, partly because ageing is a very unsexy topic. And so it's something that we really worked hard visually, creatively, materially to engage younger people in thinking about. So for me, that stands out as kind of requiring all of our creative toolbox to take an overlooked and not particularly exciting topic for most people and sort of bring it to a mainstream audience in a creative way. And in that project, we used creative visuals, we used audio, we used film, we used exciting palettes and color schemes. So we sort of used everything in that toolbox to tell that story in a way that people could really step into and immerse in it. So that's my that's my example from our practice.
Oh yeah, that's fabulous. So the next question is, what is your favourite piece of visual culture in the world?
Even more difficult question. So personally, I am very inspired by all areas of visual stroke culture, stroke storytelling. So I draw inspiration as much from books as films, as theatre, as art making, as marketing and media and retail design. So my only sadness is that I don't get to engage in all of those things as much as I would love to. But I think, you know, part core to my practice and core to the practice of the organization is that we are very multidisciplinary. And so my choice is an amazing performance piece by William Kentridge, South African artist, and it's called The Head and the Load. And yeah, we should put a link in for people to access it because it's a really incredible piece. And for me, again, it kind of brings together extraordinary theatre making, music, animation, film, set design in a kind of totally transformative experience. So yeah, something that is a end-to-end experience, but uses again everything in the kind of creative toolbox to encourage one to completely think differently and do differently as a result.
That sounds incredible. I'm not familiar with that piece, but yes, we'll try to get a link to it on the show notes. The last speedy question I'd like to ask is, what does interacting with art mean to you?
So interacting with art for me primarily means freedom. It means a freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom of discussion. And I think art thinking, art making is a way of bringing the head and the heart together in a spirit of inquiry that's very open-ended, that doesn't have a right or a wrong, a yes or a no. And for me, that's where this sense of freedom and energy comes from. So I see art making and viewing and engaging with it in any way as being the stimulus, really, to open up the imagination for deep conversation, deep thought, you know, both with one's own kind of internal self and then with peers and anyone who's prepared to go on that journey with you, really. So I think it's the portal to the imagination, and through active and radical imagining, we come up with new solutions for the challenges that we face. So I think it's essential to help us meet the challenges we face, actually.
That's beautifully put, and I wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment. Thank you so much, Sarah. Just before we go, where can our listeners go to get a taste of like the Liminal Spaces experiences? Are there any forthcoming projects that we should know about, or any current projects that are on?
Absolutely. So we have got a project on at the moment for the next few months, which is at the Francis Crick Institute. It's called Cut and Paste, and it's an exhibition and engagement process that helps people to engage on the topic of genome editing and how that's going to radically change our lives. Our website is the-liminal-space.com. So you can see most of our projects on there. And then we have a project upcoming with the V&A, which we'll be able to share more information on soon. But if you look at our site or you look at our social media handles, then you can always keep up with our activities and forthcoming events.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us, Sarah. It's been a real pleasure to have you here on Untouched, and I wish you all the best with the Liminal Spaces projects in the future.
Great. It's thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Untouched. To find out more about us, the Centre for Visual Cultures, and the projects mentioned in today's conversation, you'll find links in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions on what we've discussed, you can email us at centrefovisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk or tweet us at @rhul_CVC. This podcast is produced by the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures, located in the Languages, Literatures and Cultures Department at Royal Holloway. This episode was edited by Anna Price, with music by Gaspar Senna, and was hosted by me, Gareth Hughes. See you next time.